Yes. All right. Thank you very much. Okay. Erev Tov, everybody. Welcome to the beginning of a three-part series. It's a pleasure that we're meeting for the first time, Dr. Naomi Seidman, who is for the last couple of years being a professor at the University of Toronto. She's right now in Berkeley, California. She escaped, I think, March the 11th or something, a couple of days before the city and the world and the country, everything all closed down. She grew up in Borough Park, is a graduate of Beis Yaakov, and of course wrote the book, award-winning book, Gisara Schneer and the Beis Yaakov Movement. That's just one of the books she's written. She's working now on a study of Freud in Hebrew and Yiddish, Yiddish translation, and it's a pleasure to welcome her for the first of three-part series. As you can see, part one, Beis Yaakov between Vienna and Krakow. Vakasha, it's all yours.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Kelman, for inviting me, and thank you all for being there. Thank you, Shoshana Zolti, for writing such an amazing book about women and Torah study. And I know there are probably other people I know, but I can't see you all. And I just figured I'd have a bunch of slides so that you're not staring at me the whole time. That makes me feel more comfortable. And I have my watch here, my clock here, just so that I know to stop talking in 45 minutes and give people time to ask questions. But also, if you have a question, put it up on chat or raise your hand or flag me down if anything I'm saying isn't clear, or you have a comment or you want to complain or disagree. I'm excited to hear what you have to say. Let me just say that just one little piece of business. I realize this isn't a book launch and I'm not trying to sell books, but I, just in case, I contacted my publisher a couple of days ago and I asked whether, I happen to notice that it's very expensive on Amazon right now. I don't know why, it's probably hard to get. And I asked for a coupon. Last year when I was doing book talks, they gave me a coupon, but it's expired for 30% off. And she said she would get it to me. So if you're thinking of getting the book, I'm not saying you should or you shouldn't, just hold off because I think I'll be able to share a coupon pretty soon. So that's my main introduction. I'll just say in general, I think I'm just gonna have to say a little bit about what Beis Yaakov is. I know there are probably people who know very well what Beis Yaakov is and people who have a vague idea. And I guess it's just barely possible. There are people that don't know what Beis Yaakov is at all. So probably the first half of what I'm going to do is just a general rundown of the history before I talk about it as a phenomenon that takes the shape it does because of its location, in some sense, between spiritual location, between Vienna and Krakow, the two cities that, in some sense, gave birth to it. So, and just one more piece of... Oop, why is that not advancing? There we go. So I hope this isn't too, self-promoting, but I just wanted you to know that it seems as if I had a lot of foresight because last year around the time that my book was coming out, I spent some time with a group of fellow scholars putting as many of my primary sources as I could online so that they would be available to everyone, so that you don't have to take my word for something. If you want to know, if I mention somebody in the course of this talk that sounds interesting to you, you can go to my our website, thebeisyaakovproject.com, and click on people and see if the person is listed there. We're still collecting biographies. As much information as possible on all the people. There are many photos, many maps, documents. For instance, the Beis Yaakov Journal, we're gonna get the whole print run. I have it, I just have to finish it's all digitized. I have to finish uploading it. So uploading the print run of the Yiddish Beis Yaakov Journal, uploading the print run of the Hebrew Yarchon Beit Yaakov, uploading the English Beis Yaakov. So all the information, Beth Jacob, actually it's called, all of that's gonna be available for you to peruse eventually, and much of it is already up there. In the news, every time Beis Yaakov was mentioned, anytime in any newspaper, in any language we can read, we upload it. from the archives. Other documents are things like report cards and certificates of graduation, diplomas, letters by Sarah Schneer, etc. From the archives is theoretically a weekly blog. It's not exactly weekly, but we aspire to be weekly, where we take one thing from the archive and translate it and discuss it. And a guest book is there for people to contribute their thoughts. So that's the website for the work I do. And I hope that you'll not only peruse it, but since we put this up, we've heard from quite a few people who have family archives, including, if anybody knows, Naftali Cohn, who's a professor at Concordia, who sent us 50 photos from his grandmother's personal archive. So we continue to post that material. Okay, so what was Beis Yaakov? Maybe I'll start by saying how I came to this project. On one hand, I came to this project because I went to Beis Yaakov. On the other hand, I pretty much forgot about it for quite a while. About 10 years ago, actually exactly 10 years ago this summer, I was in Krakow. I'm wondering whether you can't see because I guess you can mostly see. I was in Krakow with a group of students from the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, where I was teaching at the time. We were there for the Jewish Culture Festival in Krakow, which is an amazing culture festival. I think it's the largest Jewish culture festival in the world, and it's run by non-Jews. You know, I was there with a group of students, and I was in the courtyard of the Ramoth Synagogue, a 16th century shul, survived and, you know, intact the war. And I saw a group of Beis Yaakov girls, and I was really surprised to see them there. I asked them if they were there for the festival, and they said no, they were there to visit the grave of the woman who founded their school system. They didn't know I was also a Beis Yaakov girl. I said, oh, Sarah Schneer. And later that day, I was walking back to my hotel, and I bumped into the director of the festival, and he said, have you know, anything interesting happened? And I said, yeah, I you know that there are these Orthodox adolescent girls that travel to Poland on their own, and they're visiting the grave of this woman who's buried in Krakow. Her name is Sarah Schneer. And I said, you know, I knew that there were Hasidim coming and paying pilgrimage to the Rebbes. I knew that there were people coming back and going to their old, where their families came from. Did you know this was happening? And he said he had no idea, despite having lived in Krakow his entire life. And why don't I give a talk on this at next year's festival? And I gave a talk on Beis Yaakov at the festival next year. And Connie Weber, who's the editor of the Littman Library, said to me, came over afterwards and said, write a book. So that's how I wrote the book. And for some of you who've read the book, I'm sorry to be repeating this story. This is how I started. I still think it's a fascinating phenomenon that people just don't know about. They assume that Orthodox Jews are men. Orthodox Jews, by definition, wear black hats, right? The fact that there might be a few women among them, what they do, who knows? They must have some kind of version of whatever the men do. To discover that there's an entire culture that's unique to Orthodox girls, that's not just a male variation of whatever the men are doing, let's say in a more insular way or whatever the people imagine, is just wrong. Basically, what you see is an entire culture around Orthodox women that's very ramified, very organized. There you see a tombstone put up by a group of graduates of Beis Yaakov. The photo at the bottom is from the Barclay Center in Brooklyn, which has been in the news in the last few days, where Sarah Schneer's 80th yard site was observed, with school buses coming from all over the East Coast and maybe further. And this is what I mean when I talk about a culture that's not just a shadow copy of what men are doing, but a unique culture with unique cultural formations that don't fit into the categories that describe the rest of the Orthodox world. People say, oh, are you yeshivish? Yeshiva, okay, Hasidish, yeshivish, Beis Yaakov. Beis Yaakov transcended all those categories and still transcends those categories in certain ways. So this is what I'm interested in analyzing, is what is this phenomenon that is Beis Yaakov, which had such a powerful impact on certainly girls and women's lives in, you know, the 20th century and up to today, in the Orthodox world, but also Orthodoxy in general. It's hard to imagine Orthodoxy now without the effects of Beis Yaakov. So what was Beis Yaakov? Let me see if I can, here we go. Well, you can't talk about Beis Yaakov without talking about Sarah Schneer, the founder of Beis Yaakov. Those are her dates. She died at a very young age, 51 years old, of stomach cancer. Stomach cancer is among the phrases that you often don't find in the literature because, I don't know, for those of you who grew up Orthodox, there's certain taboos about talking about cancer ailments. There are many other parts of Sarah Schneer's life that are very hard to find out about, including until about 10 years ago, what she looked like. The photo on the right, the small passport photo, it's actually her application for an identity card. It was discovered, quote unquote, in the archives about 10 years ago. And until 10 years ago, maybe it was even 8 years ago, the only images that we had of Beis Yaakov were this one drawing that circulated in the interwar period and was later made into some kind of stamp. I'm not really sure. I can't remember where I got this image. So I don't know if it's an official Israeli stamp or some kind of school stamp. But it's taken from the drawing that was the frontispiece of Sarah Schneer's collected writings. I have right here, Gesammelte Schriften. I have the second edition, which no longer has that image. It has images of men. So this is Gesammelte Schriften, which is Sarah Schneer's collected writings. When that book came out, it was advertised as the first sefer by a Jewish woman. In other words, not a book. There were books by Jewish women, right? But this is a sefer. So this is exactly what it is a little hard to say, but it was intended, it was at least advertised in Beis Yaakov as something that you should treat as a sefer, not just as a book. So who is Sarah Schneer? She was a seamstress who came from a family that was started off, I think, somewhat middle class and lost a lot of money at a certain point. And she had to leave school. So she only had an eighth grade education. She's often called in the literature, so the Orthodox literature about her, the Beis Yaakov literature, is hagiographic, right? So it paints her in these kind of perfect saintly terms. And certain parts of her life are emphasized and certain parts are covered over. I would say that she lived in a rather mixed milieu. She had a family that ranged from, I've read that she had 9 siblings and also that she had 13 siblings. So I'm not sure how many siblings she had, but we do know that some of her siblings were completely secular and some of her siblings were entirely Hasidish. It was her two brothers that were Hasidish. She was a rare woman in the family, and the assumption was that the women in the family would be less from than the men. And she was treated, she hung out with her sister and did the sorts of things that we would call, I don't know, modern Orthodox. Barely went to the theater, we now know more about the lectures she went to. She went to a lecture about birth control and sexual hygiene. We know these things from a recently discovered Polish diary that she kept between the years 1909 and 1913. She was married. She actually wished she could live a Hasidish lifestyle, but that wasn't available for a girl in her, a woman in her family. We call her in 1909. She married actually rather late, and she, when she got engaged, she had a kind of miserable first marriage. When she got engaged, she complained that she was given jewelry when she was jealous of her brother, who got a chasse for when he got engaged. So, you know, volumes of Talmud. So she was unhappy. She wanted to be more religious, which was difficult for her as a woman. She was a truly spiritual, religious person, very poetic soul, in love with nature, etc., who had these kinds of vague dreams already, you know, in her diary in 1909, of doing something with women, for women, with women, that was spiritual and Jewish. In her diary, which is going to be published and it's going to blow everybody's mind, she says, I probably can't even do it here in Poland. Maybe I'll run off to America. Okay, that was Sarah Schneer. I could talk about her a lot more, but let's move on to her project. This is what Sarah Schneer did pretty much almost, let's say, well, maybe I won't say single-handedly, but part of this single-handedly. Sarah Schneer was the founder of a girls' school system in Poland called Besiakov, actually named by the Aguda chapter of Krakow that she affiliated with in 1919, after the verse in Exodus, I believe it is, Ko tamar levet Yaakov v'tagid levnei Yisrael, so shall you say to the people of Israel and children of to the house of Jacob and the children of Israel. This is the house of Jacob. Rashi says, children of Jacob, house of Jacob, Elu HaNashim, these are the women. This was taken in Beis Yaakov as warrant, not only for the giving of the Torah to women, but the giving of the Torah first to women, right? Because Ko Tamar Levet Yaakov comes before the Tagid Livnei Yisrael. And in Beis Yaakov, in the new interwar period, Gimel Sivan, 3 days before Shavuos, when these words were ostensibly said, that was called the Beis Yaakov holiday. So this is just an example of some of the wild innovations of Beis Yaakov in the interwar period. But back to this chart. Sarah Schneer opened up a school in 1917 in her seamstress studio, which by 1923 had grown to 7 schools and had a little seminary in the original studio building in which she was actually living with a group of adolescent girls. By 1924, she was farming these adolescents. She was already farming these young girls out to start schools. She would go to a town in the neighborhood, typically. She would take her oldest student with her. Some of these girls started as apprentices in her seamstress studio, and teaching girls how to sew was part of Beis Yaakov from the first to the end. She would take a girl with her to a small town, and she would give a talk to the town, and she would say how long, she would be speaking in some public hall to the mothers and fathers of the town. We know she spoke to men and women in these small town settings. And she would say, how long will you sit idly by as you watch your daughters drift from you, as you watch them join the communist circles or the Zionist circles or the socialist circles, as they sit by the Shabbos table reading romances while and poo-pooing your old-fashioned ways. The background to that was a kind of devastating wave of especially girls leaving the Orthodox world to become secular, to become prostitutes even, to join radical youth organizations. If you want to talk more about that, I'm happy to. At the why women, why prostitution, etc. I'm happy to talk about all that. During the Q&A. I'm worried I have to race through all this material. Okay.
Okay, you can take your time a little bit. You can go a little beyond. I would go a little beyond 45 minutes. It's fine.
Am I talking too fast?
No. I'm just saying, okay. Don't worry about, you can go till closer to 9:30 and take questions towards the end. Right. That's fine.
So 1924, so this looks like, so basically she, and then if some of the parents would start crying, everybody had a daughter that had gone off the derech, as we now say. And she would say, if you want to start a Beis Yaakov school here is Malka. And Malka, who was 15 years old, would start speaking about she too was attracted by the offerings of the street of Krakow, and then she met Sarah Schneer, and she spent the Shabbos around Sarah Schneer's table, and now there's no greater spiritual pleasure for her than the time she has, the time that she spends around Sarah Schneer. And Sarah Schneer says, this is your Beis Yaakov teacher if you want her. And someone in the town has to put her up. Of course, no teenage boys in the family, in the house, will put her up. And this girl, the 15-year-old, would be expected to open up the school and collect tuition and find the place and round up the students and also start a youth movement and put on a play. And then not only that, go around to five other towns in the neighboring district and get those people to open up a Beis Yaakov. Basically, what you see here is a Ponzi scheme. This chart is astonishing. Don't take it for granted that somebody could start like that and, you know, without modern means of communication, create a school system which by 1939 had over 40,000 students and somewhere between 250 and 300 schools, and many other things that I'll talk about. But I just want to say one thing about this chart, which is that the chart is actually a little bit misleading. If you look at the chart really closely, you'll notice that at one point that dramatic rate of growth actually almost stops. And that's between 1925 and 1926. So between 1925 and 1926, you go, as opposed to from 22 to 49, and from 49 to 55. So what happened between 1925 and 1926? In 1925, in the spring of 1925, the Aguda finally made good on its promise to help Sarah Schneer, and they show up, and they have a Beis Yaakov conference. This is a turning point, and they go, in 1924, actually, they visit the school, and what we're talking about is a bunch of German Jewish professional, modern neo-Orthodox men, and they walk into the school, and they're horrified at what they see, and they basically shut it down. So the reason why it only grows at the rate of 6 is because they shut down operations in order to start it again more professionally. And I actually believe that at this moment in time, I don't have full proof, they intended to wrest the school away from Sarah Schneer. It didn't work. They closed down her building. They bought another building 8 blocks away. You start reading the memoirs of people who went to the other building, the one with the eight rooms instead of the 2 rooms, and there's Sarah Schneer. I believe she actually followed them to the next school. So Aguda basically tried to take over Beis Yaakov unsuccessfully. Sarah Schneer was too beloved, too important, too symbolic a figure, and she was embraced again. Her role in the school only grew after that, and continued to grow, and I believe is at its high point right now. So Sarah Schneer, how to think about her in relationship to Beis Yaakov is actually way more complicated than just the idea of she's the founder. But let me keep going about what Beis Yaakov is. So here's a map drawn by, I got this wrong in the book. I have to do another edition. I made so many mistakes. I don't know how you publish a book. It's terrifying. So I think I said that this map was 1935 because that was when it was finally published, but it was actually drawn up in 1931. And it was drawn up by that group of Aguda men who came from Central Europe, who took a trip around Poland in 1931 to visit the great landmarks of Orthodoxy, to meet with their counterparts, their Eastern European counterparts. I'll talk about what the Aguda is in a moment. They met with the Chafetz Chaim. They went to, they visited Lublin to see the yeshiva, which I think was just opening up that year, or maybe it was the next year, the yeshiva that they supported. Basically, the Aguda in Central Europe was funded a lot of stuff in Eastern Europe and helped people organize, and was incredibly instrumental in Beis Yaakov, because Orthodox men in Poland had much less experience talking to women, dealing with women, thinking about women, thinking about gender, than the ones from Germany did. So these men made a real point of meeting with Sarah Schneer. They went to Rapka. I have photographs of them in the mountains, at the resorts, at the resort where the girls were hanging out in the summer. They saw the amazing sight of girls learning under the Torah, under the trees. And they drew up this map of Beis Yaakov schools in Poland and Lithuania. And they tried to basically, most of the material that you find from the interwar period is in German, interestingly enough. And the language of instruction in the seminary was often German, because despite the fact that these men were operating from Vienna, they were the ones that professionalized the school, that organized it, that drew up these maps. There's a map of, by 1931, Beis Yaakov schools already existed also in other places. And there's a map of the places in which they existed in Austria, Czechoslovakia, Romania, Hungary, Germany, etc. So Beis Yaakov, by 1931, after 14 years of Sarah Schneer's activity, and after 6 years of the Aguda really involving themselves in it, was already an international school system. Let me move. So what was Beis Yaakov? Most of what Beis Yaakov was after-school programs, often with no legal status, basically one-room schools run by an 18-year-old, a 19-year-old, in which students would be, in which students would be, the group of the youngest girls, and, and then the second youngest girls, et cetera, et cetera. So in which they would basically learn a basic curriculum of davening, et cetera, a little chumash, a little Hebrew reading, et cetera. Nothing too fancy. And these schools were typically underfunded and fly by the seat of their pants operations, etc. And a few of them actually became more sophisticated, became full-day schools. In 1925, when the Aguda took it over, the first thing they resolved was that all these schools should become all-day schools, and they should teach secular subjects, and the Jewish kids should be taken out of the public schools where they were learning. They didn't manage to accomplish it in many places. They accomplished it in the big cities, in Warsaw and in, Lodz and in places like that. There were more than one Beis Yaakov. There were Beis Yaakovs in different neighborhoods. And in some of the, more prominent shtetlach, Slonim had a full day school. But most of them remained these kind of after-school programs up through the interwar period. There were also vocational programs. So Sarah Schneer, being a dressmaker, people call her a seamstress. She was actually a high-end dressmaker. She also believed that girls should get training, vocational training. So right from the very beginning, dressmaking was part of the programs of these schools. It's also the case that Beis Yaakov, as it developed, as a ramified school system, professionalized. And by the 1930s, there were also vocational schools where you can go. In, there were two, one in Lodz, one in Warsaw, with hundreds of young women studying Jewish subjects half the day and the other half of the day getting degrees in nursing, bookkeeping, dressmaking, early childhood education, etc. Full-fledged vocational schools. The one in Lodz was called Ohel Sara. It was renamed Ohel Sara in 1935 in honor of Sarah Schnerer. Talk a lot about what Ohel Sara means, but this was the vocational training program done with the help of Bertha Pappenheim, who was on the board of the Beis Yaakov and a social worker herself. So just to move along, on the bottom left, you see a postcard of one of the first Beis Yaakov high schools. And this one happens to be in Ponevezh. And it's no coincidence, I said it happens to be, but it's no coincidence that one of the first Beis Yaakov high schools opened in Ponevezh. The Ponevezh, of course, was a yeshiva town. The yeshiva towns lobbied to have high schools built within them, both in Lithuania and in Poland, because the Rosh Yeshiva and the, just like the Rebbes, the Hasidic Rebbes, they were in desperate, the marriage market, if you want to call it that, was totally unbalanced because of the great wave of defections from Orthodoxy by girls. And there were many, 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 you know, old bacharim, as we call them, the old bachelors that couldn't find a woman. And women were scarce and precious commodities in interwar Orthodoxy, which I'm persuaded has something to do with the acceptance of the need to teach girls Torah and the freedom that these schools were given to develop their own culture. When you're a rare commodity and your value is and your value is high, then the market moves to satisfy whatever you want, including funds that were raised, or stories about Gera Hasidim that raised funds to start a Beis Medrash or a Shtibel, or I don't remember exactly what it was. And Sarah Schnerer came to town, and one of them stood up and says, I donate all the funds that we collected for the Beis Medrash to the Beis Yaakov. This was understood to be a primary, even if men's Torah study is valued greater because it's obligatory, in this case, because of this urgent situation, girls' schools were seen as desperate necessities. So along with the small schools in the small towns, the after-school programs, the full-day programs in some of the larger shtetlach and the cities, and the high schools, again, in some of the larger towns and in some yeshiva towns, the vocational training program. What really everyone was fascinated by and what got the huge proportion of the attention of outside observers was the seminary. Oh, you know what? Let me talk about the theater for a minute. So I said that these after-school programs were not always of the highest quality. Students came and left, teachers came and left, etc. One thing they were famous for right from the start was theater. So Beis Yaakov Theater is, we have many, many, many photos of Beis Yaakov plays, and it continues to be the case that Beis Yaakov Theater is really an important part of the Beis Yaakov experience. I just love these photos. The one on the left, the bottom left, is from Buchach, as my father said, which was my father's hometown. And it's just possible that the teacher in this photo is my aunt, who I never met, who was killed in the Holocaust. The play looks like it was Mechiras Yosef, the selling of Joseph, which is a common play in the Purim Spiel circuit, maybe because there are so many male parts. In this case, all the girls have the male parts. That it was part of the fun, and still part of the fun of being in a Beis Yaakov play, is getting to put on a beard. And there are jokes about that. B'makom she'ein bo ish, in a place where there is no man, someone's got to be the man. Someone's got to play Pharaoh. Another thing that struck me about this photo, and which is maybe partially verified by another photo that I found on Google Images, is how similar the characters look to the Polish Passion Play characters. The photo on the top left is a photo of a Christmas nativity play. And if you look closely, you can see the same stars on people's heads. It's at least possible that some of these plays, some of these girls, were in a Polish nativity play in the public school during the day and wore the same costume to play the Mechirat Yosef. I don't have any evidence of this, but I think it's at least possible. The play on the right, you can see, this is one of the plays that the photos that I got from Naftali Cohn, a family archive. We actually have the title of the play. It's called Kantonisten. Young boys that are taken away to serve in the Tsarist army. It's a historical play about the early 19th century and the terrible trauma of the draft and how poor Jewish boys were actually sold into the army, kidnapped into the army. Another play with a lot of male parts. One of the things you see in Beis Yaakov photos. Don't take my word for it. They're all on my website. Here's a very early advertisement for a Beis Yaakov play that came out of Beis Yaakov Shedlitz, I think it's called in Yiddish. The Polish pronunciation is a little different. That's typical. And there's a lot of things to notice about this. But what I want to point out is you see right at the very bottom, Eingang nur für Frauen. These plays were just for women. They're not one of the, this one I looked up what the date was. March 3rd in 1926 was Shushan Purim, the day after Purim. So this is a kind of female variation of a Purim spiel. So it's not as if this is totally created from scratch. But I do think that the theater culture of Beis Yaakov was not, again, simply a Purim spiel culture. All kinds of innovations that remain to be explored are part of this culture. And I just want to point out that this is continuing to our own day. And what you're seeing now is the one on the right, sorry, is a musical film. It says also written and directed by Rachel Frey. And it says, you can't see it too well, but these both say, one of them was shown at the Jerusalem Film Festival, and it says only for women. So this idea of a culture, what does it mean to create a culture that's only for women? How does sexual segregation, the very strong rules of sexual segregation in the Orthodox community, create these distinct cultural products? Is one of my, let's say, continuing research interests. This is Rapka, a resort town, one of the most beautiful resort towns in the Tatra Mountains in the south of Poland. And the house on the right is, if you look at it closely, you can see those are full of girls standing on the steps. Do you see that? And looking out the windows and up on the top balconies. And there is a similar group on the right. In 1925, when these Aguda professionals from Vienna came to basically professionalize Beis Yaakov, make it more hygiene, introduce them to the concept of a textbook, they brought in teachers from Germany and Austria to young women raised in the modern Orthodox, Shamshon Raphael Hirsch milieu, some of them getting PhDs at the University of Frankfurt, and they brought them in to teach these girls Torah from a kind of Hirschian perspective. If you look at this particular photo, I can't point to it. I don't know how to do that. But there's a woman with a white collar. She's about five from the right, sitting on the grass with a dark dress. That is Judith Rosenbaum. She was brought from Frankfurt by Jakob Rosenheim, the president of Aguda. Notice she's the same age or barely a few years older than these girls. The girl that's standing is actually one of the students. She's taking her turn being a practice teacher. The seminary was brought to the mountains and she's taking a turn student. Her name is Tzila Orlean, later Sarutskin. She's known as the Angel of Auschwitz for saving people's lives and managing to keep some degree of Jewish law in those conditions. She married a very important Aguda figure, moved to Israel after the war. She survived and was known as Rebbetzin Sarutskin. When you start looking at these photographs, you actually can recognize people after a while. There's the same people in all these photos. This was the crown jewel of what Sarah Schneer accomplished. In this regard, I think you can talk about a female variation of a male phenomenon. This was the Yeshivas Chachmei Lublin of Beis Yaakov. These girls were learning Torah at the highest level. To get into the seminary attracted girls from throughout the world. To get in, you had to know, you already had to know a lot. And the curriculum was incredibly difficult and stringent and professional. Influenced by the most cutting edge pedagogy imported from the University of Frankfurt Education Department. My mother, who went to Chernovitz, the seminary in Chernovitz, talked about reading Freud in the seminary on child psychology, and one of also creative, democratic, one of their assignments was to take a non-human character in Tehillim and Psalms and do some kind of interpretation of a blade of grass, etc. So this was the contribution of Frankfurt to seminary education. So here was some more images from the seminary. This is the seminary building under construction. These are girls lounging in the grass outside the seminary, between the seminary and the river, the Vistula River. There's a seminary diploma. I'm just going to race through. One of the things I discovered, so what was Beis Yaakov? Beis Yaakov was a total institution, to use Devorah Weissman's term. It was an institution that was slogans and holidays and theater and a network of schools, a network of youth movements. It basically removed girls from the dysfunctional Jewish home and embedded them almost entirely in a world that just was girls. Beis Yaakov, when you graduated the seminary, you were not allowed to go home before you went to your first assignment. Partly it was a desperate shortage of teachers, and partly it was don't get involved in shidduchim, was what they said. This is your life. Girls postpone. It was part of the policy of Beis Yaakov for girls to delay marriage and just devote themselves to the system as it was now. This is the songbook, which if you want to hear a bunch of girls singing, Beis Yaakov girls, the next Beis Yaakov singing these songs, you can find that on our website too. I took, that's a photo of Eliezer Schindler, who wrote the Bais Yaakov songbook. The Bais Yaakov song. There was also a contest for the Bais Yaakov Benos anthem. He didn't win that. There was someone else who won the Benos anthem, but he wrote the Bais Yaakov Gesang, which is actually the one song in the songbook that, that people still remember, that's still sung a little bit today. The Bais Yaakov song, the reason I have a picture of him, he was a disciple of Nathan Birnbaum, who's the general secretary of the Aguda. He was a Polish Jew who moved to Germany and became a poet, and then was caught up in the Aguda, and was especially involved in the Aguda, in Nathan Birnbaum's initiative of that was called Olim or Olim, which was a group of young poets, what could be called the far left wing of the Aguda, if you can imagine such a thing, which was basically socialists, mystics, and agriculturalists who believed that Jews should live in voluntary collective poverty, working the soil and learning Torah. And this was a movement that did not entirely get off the ground. As far as I can tell, I'm still researching that. But Eliezer Schindler moved to Lakewood, New Jersey, and started a farm there, and accepted pilgrimages of Bais Yaakov girls. I have on the website, I have a little description of a visit of some former seminary students to Lakewood to pay homage to the writer of the Bais Yaakov hymn, one of the poets who wrote for the movement. And Eliezer Schindler writes about, my father actually wrote the article describing how Eliezer Schindler played, his wife played the piano and he sang the song, this song, and tears streaming down his face thinking, who knows if anyone will ever sing this song again. So one of my aims is to reintroduce this repertoire to Bais Yaakov today. It's a little bit ironic that he ended up in Lakewood. Oh, one more thing about him. He's the father of Alexander Schindler, who was the executive director of the Reform Movement, but he also had a Frum daughter who lived in Berkeley for many years and was Frum her entire life and was perfect for the Berkeley Frum community. Here are some pictures of Benos. Benos was the Bais Yaakov Youth Movement, founded by, I could see, I'm just going to get to the introduction. Sorry, we'll talk about Vienna and Krakow next time. So these are photos. They're all photos from the same family archive. I love this. This is the graduation of Dvorah Cohn in the summer of 1934 from the Bais Yaakov Seminary. She's sitting, she's third on the bottom row on the right, third from the right. In a dark dress and a white collar with and there she is in the cart on the way to Lake Morsky, which is the lake in the Zakopane region that they went to as a graduation trip. And you could see her, all of this is in our website. That's the deepest lake in Poland next to the tallest mountain in the Tatra mountain range. And this was the most popular Jewish resort, heavily Jewish resort in Poland at the time. So among the things that Bais Yaakov was a kind of nature cult. Sarah Schneer herself was an avid hiker, and she introduced hiking as a religious act to Bais Yaakov. Maybe when I talk about how Bais Yaakov was Hasidic, I'll get into that a little bit more. These are the Benos pictures. Benos Agudas Yisrael was a youth movement for graduates of Bais Yaakov to keep them in the fold. Girls typically graduated at the age of 15. So these are working girls often, and they spend their evenings at the Benos Club, hanging out at the Benos Library, and going on Benos trips during the summer, spending time in colonies, which are kind of camps. We have many, many pictures of Benos girls. And Benos also themselves started a youth movement for younger girls called Basia. I'll just say one thing about this is the Beis Yaakov Journal. Unfortunately, the picture of the director, I think, is not visible to you, Laser Friedenson, but you can see him on the website.
Yeah, I see it anyways on my computer, yes.
Ah, okay. The Beis Yaakov Journal was founded by Eliezer Gershon Friedenson. It's the longest running journal directed toward women in Yiddish in the interwar period. It had something like 150 issues between 1923 and 1929. And it was founded even before the Agudah Conference of 1923, in which the Agudah voted to adopt Beis Yaakov and embrace it as part of its activities. About 2 months before that first World Congress of the Beis Yaakov, of the Agudah, a young Agudah activist shows up at Sarah Schneer's door and says, "How can I help you?" And the story he told her, and he told everybody else, which illustrates who he was and what Beis Yaakov was that he was an Agudah activist. The Agudah actively recruited among the same teenagers that the communists did, that the socialists did, that the Zionists did. It was a very, volatile landscape, and it was all up for grabs. And the Agudah would go to, you know, some town and send an activist there and make a speech at some shul or some, or the theater even sometimes. And Friedenson says, whatever the communists threw at me, I could answer. He was also a part of Poale Agudas Yisrael, which is basically the Orthodox Socialist group. I think we can now say that they weren't just, well, I feel much more comfortable since reading some recent scholarship and calling them straightforwardly Orthodox Socialists. So he didn't have any problem talking to communists. He didn't have any problem talking to socialists. He didn't have any problem talking to Zionists. The one thing that really threw him was when one young lefty said to him, "Great, whatever you say is beautiful, but let me tell you something. All your girls are in our clubs." And Friedenson didn't know what to say. And he was thrown for a loop. And someone said to him, "You know what? There's some crazy lady in Krakow who's got something going where she's surrounded by teenage girls who will do anything, who just want nothing more than to follow her to the ends of the earth. Go meet her." And he went and met her, and he said, "I'm at your service." And she said, "You know what we need is a newsletter." And 2 months later, the first issue of the Beis Yaakov Journal came out, which unfortunately I have not managed to find in an archive, but I have seen number 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. They're all on their website. I was going to talk about the Krakow Conference and the Agudah. I really actually think I should probably stop talking now, and let's open it up to discussion, and I'll talk more about what was supposed to be the theme, Beis Yaakov between German Neo-Orthodoxy and Eastern European Hasidism next time. So how's that for a teaser?
Okay, good. You've got the question. Why don't you just take a look at a question on the chat box? I am teased already, you know. I'm happy to,
So I'm going to stop sharing. And where is the chat box?
On the right. If you want, I can say the questions. You see it? You see the chat box? Okay, so let me...
Is it the smiley face with the plus?
No, I don't know. 14. You probably have to
chat.
Oh my
God, 14.
You have it? Okay.
When was it published? Oh, I'm so sorry. So when was it published? If you talk about Gesammelte Schriften, it was published in 1933. This is the second edition. There were only two editions. It's a shame that it's not in continual print. This is this 1955 edition. On the 20th anniversary of Sarah Schneer's website. This is available from download at the Yiddish Book Center. So anybody can read it, and I recommend it. Oh, so what were the Agudah visitors horrified about? They said that it, Grunfeld, oh my God, yes, I made a mistake. I mis, So let me just go through the questions really quickly. So the Gouda visitors were horrified about what they called the lack of hygiene. Sershner was living in a two-room tenement apartment in the red light district of Krakow with somewhere between 25 and 50 adolescent girls who were sleeping, learning in this two-room apartment. Two to a bed. They were horrified. Basically the only reading material was Sershner's kind of oral, the only textbooks were people, the notes from her own teachings. Was everything taught in Hebrew, Yiddish, or Polish? Great question. As I said, in the seminary, the language of instruction was often German. My mother, whose first language was Hungarian, had to learn German to go to the seminary. Not only that, but you had to have read Hirsch's 19 letters in German to be admitted. So the Yiddish was actually, I'll talk about Yiddish, I think, next time, unless it gets pushed to the time after. Yiddish, in 1929, Beis Yaakov became Yiddishist, moved over to Yiddish, and the language of instruction, as much as possible, became Yiddish. What does it mean that in 1929, Beis Yaakov became Yiddishist, Orthodox Yiddishist? Stay tuned. Rebbetzin Grunfeld, that's right, I think I called her Judith Rosenbaum Grunfeld. She was later known as Rebbetzin Grunfeld after she married Diane Grunfeld in London, eventually in London. So how similar are Beis Yaakovs in America today to interwar Poland? That's the topic of my last talk. So I'll dangle that in front of you. The next session is the same time. If you mean of this class, same time, same place next year. Was Beis Yaakov anti-Zionist? Complicated. Officially, yes, like the Aguda. Unofficially, Beis Yaakov was not organized enough to really push any one agenda. Among the evidence I heard of the Shoah archives, people talking about their Beis Yaakov experience, one woman talks about having learned Hatikva at Beis Yaakov. There are pictures of Beis Yaakovs where they have the Zionist flag. So Beis Yaakov was officially anti-Zionist, but there were lots of Zionists in it. Just like the Aguda, it was a squishy border, or at least there were lots of sympathy. The border between the anti-Zionists, and it was complicated because Beis Yaakov had started a kibbutz. In 1934, they sent a group of girls from Lodz to Tel Aviv to start a kibbutz. They called themselves kibbutz. They called it hachshara. They had all kinds of, you know what? Maybe I'll add Zionism to one of the five things we discuss next time. What was Zionism in terms of Beis Yaakov? Languages in the high school. In the high school, they taught Polish. In some of the high schools even had kind of the most elite ones. In the big cities, they even taught Latin. But certainly Polish was taught in all the schools. Were there male teachers or only female? Great question. In the small schools were run by teenage girls. The big cities had male administrators and often male teachers. And Yudeleib Orleans was, all of this was complicated. How do you have men teaching in the seminary, when Yehudaleib Orleans, the director, the principal of the Beis Yaakov Seminary, starting in the early 30s, when he moved to Krakow to take up that position, he had to get permission from the Gerer Rebbe. And in the early years, there were all kinds of responsa about exactly what men can do and couldn't do in the schools. I just remembered something I was going to say about the whole question of sexual segregation is so interesting in general, and how men and women interacted. The plays, they're only for women, they're only for women and girls, but boys would dress up like girls to sneak into the plays because they were the most amazing things happening in a lot of these small towns. You can read about that on my website too. Did she remarry after her the first picture you showed, how can it not be a woman? There's no beard. Isn't that a dress? I don't know. Mark, we got to talk about it. I didn't know you were here, Mark. I've stared at that picture for so long. I think it's a young boy, but I don't know. You know, Uriel Birnbaum was an interesting guy. That's all I can say. Sarah Schneer was married twice from 1910 to 1913. And then again in the 30s, at the very end of her life, she was married to a frummer guy, someone more her type. She was divorced. She begged to be divorced. She was desperate to get divorced. For Limudei Kodesh, did they learn in Hebrew? I think they did. I'm not 100% sure. I think they learned in Beis Yaakov Ivris, which is its own thing. It's actually the Ivris that I grew up with, right? It's not like any other. It's not like what the boys learned. They learned, a boy would say Beis Yaakov. Beis Yaakov, they taught also influenced by the German Neo-Orthodoxy, an academic, what might be called an academic idiolect. A variety of Hebrew that's only spoken in Beis Yaakov. Did the girls pay tuition? Yes. Was there a class element? Wonderful question. Beis Yaakov, the seminary was expensive. The letters that are popping up about Beis Yaakov for $2,000, somebody just tried to sell me. Anyone wants to do big mitzvah? No, it's not a big mitzvah. Anyone wants to buy a letter by Sarah Schneer? From Sarah Schneer, they're selling for $2,000-$3,000. What are the letters all about? You got to let my niece into the seminary. It was, at least theoretically, it was a meritocracy. In fact, it wasn't. And there's a lot of complaints about that. So the whole, you know, who is it? This fascinating stuff about class and the yeshiva. Yeshiva was also technically a meritocracy, and in fact, not. So the person who writes about that is Shaul, what's his last name, who writes about the yeshiva world.
Stamfer.
Okay, what?
Stamfer.
Stamfer, exactly. He has a brilliant article about how the myth of meritocracy covered a very serious class issues. Beis Yaakov was from middle class women, and like the yeshiva world, they were often slumming it. So when Deutschlander came to Sarah Schneer's little, you know, cult, they called it a cult openly, her studio apartment where she's living with 50 girls, 25 girls, he said he was shocked to realize that the girls came from nice Balabatish families. They were playing poor, just like yeshiva boys played poor. They were living in a kind of voluntary poverty, but it wasn't poor girls that it could afford to be voluntarily poor. So great question. Was there initial resistance to Rabbanim to the school movement? Yes, absolutely. The Beis Yaakov was called Beis Esav by the Munkacher. There's a whole group of in the what's called the Oberlander. The Transylvania, Hungary, and Czechoslovakia, you know, the map of Eastern Europe, that's the hardest thing for me in trying to understand this world. There's this region of Eastern Europe where they actually needed Beis Yaakov for the same reasons, because they had girls running away to become prostitutes. But they couldn't call them Beis Yaakovs because Beis Yaakovs were treif. So they called them other things, you know, Benosara or whatever. Why was the Munkacher so against Beis Yaakov? Because you could walk by Kolisha. You could walk you could walk through the streets of a shtetl, you walk by the Beis Yaakov, and you hear 50 girls singing loud. They love to sing. And since when is that allowed? It wasn't even the whole question of, kolam lamei Torah levito kilu lundati flut. It wasn't that halachic question. They managed to figure out how to get around that one in various ways. I mean, that was already figured out a long time ago. Okay, I could talk about that a lot more, but today, yeshiva, Yehuda Greenfield, man, you got great questions. Where are you, Yehuda? Show yourself. Yeshiva, why do girls pronounce Hebrew differently? Great question. And I think that it shows that it's actually, I think the fact that there are now some yeshivas that pronounce Hebrew the way Beis Yaakov does, I think that's the influence of Beis Yaakov versus then the other way around. That Beis Yaakov actually created a way of pronouncing Hebrew that was, and a way of studying Hebrew. Until Beis Yaakov, Hebrew wasn't taught in the yeshiva. When my mother was in the DP camp, there's a Orthodox Holocaust museum in Brooklyn, and you can see this on their website, an SS order booklet where my mother had written a Hebrew textbook on the back of the pages because there was no paper. The idea of studying Hebrew grammar was unique to girls. The difference between a boy and a girl, the same family, the girl would have a totally different education than the boy. This is what I mean. And among the things that's different, I mean, many things are different, but among the things that are different is a professional approach to the study of language. So Yiddish taught through textbooks, Hebrew taught through textbooks. Textbooks were in the discussions of the rabbis, whoever heard of textbooks, are you allowed to have a textbook to teach Yahadus, as we called it? What's Yahadus? We don't know what that is. And the textbooks were an invention of German neo-orthodoxy, and they said textbooks are okay for girls, for boys not. For boys, the traditional way of learning, call it not learning, will carry on. Girls can have textbooks. So those are some of the ways. My mother was in Fehrenwald. Her name was Sarah Abraham. I talk about her a little bit on one of the blogs. Any other questions? Okay, I think, did I make my way through all of them in record time?
I think so.
I think it's over, 6:38. I'm keeping you guys.
In Berkeley, it's 6:38. In Toronto, it's 9:38.
Some of you have already fallen asleep, or maybe you're
already. It's still early. The night is young. Really, thank you very much. Pleasure. We're going to have to talk. I know you're busy. We'll have to talk about extending the series. I see. I don't think we can get everything in.
As you can see, don't get me started.
we're like Dr. Mark Shapiro, who really, it was his idea. I want to thank him. I know he's online.
Oh, Mark, thank you so much. Where is Mark? Is he here?
He's somewhere here, I believe.
Mark, thank you. I really owe you a particular thanks.
It was his idea to make this shidduch, and I want to thank him. And like his classes, we started, there'll be two classes, ends up being eight classes, a little bit. Baruch Hashem, there's a lot to learn. And thank you very much. Tomorrow night, our next online for now is going to be tomorrow night, 8:30, Parshat HaShavua, Adina Berkowitz. I'll be speaking 9:30 Friday morning on Pirkei Avot. And then next week, we'll even be having more classes than this week. So a pleasure to see everybody. Laila Tov, be well. And
wonderful to meet you all. Comments. Be well, yeah. Stay safe.
Yes, amen. That's for sure. Okay, that's what I always say, the most important thing. And we should continue to learn with your class, other classes throughout the thing, other places, and Laila Tov to everybody. And probably at 6:38 means it's supper time.
not quite
supper time. Okay.